From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Dan Walters has been a journalist for more than half a century, spending all but a few of those years working for California newspapers. At one point in his career, at age 22, he was the nation's youngest daily newspaper editor. Mr. Walters joined the Sacramento Union's Capital Bureau in 1975, just as Jerry Brown began his governorship, and later became the Union's Capital Bureau chief. In 1981, he began writing the state's only daily newspaper column devoted to California political, economic, and social events. By 1974, he and his column had moved to the Sacramento Bee. He has written more than 7,500 columns about California and its politics, and his column now appears in more than 50 California newspapers. He's also written several books. In another of our multi-part retrospective series on California politics, we'll discuss how state government has changed with one of the leading commentators on state politics, the Sacramento Bee's political columnist, Dan Walters. We'll also hear from Tom Holyoke, a political science professor at California State University, Fresno, John Ellis, a political reporter for the Fresno Bee, and Nate Monroe, a political science professor from UC Merced. California Retrospective, a conversation with Dan Walters of the Sacramento Bee.
From Fresno, the Maddie Report, with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. When I was first appointed to lead the Maddie Institute, our then chairman, Don Jackson, told me that Dan Walters' columns were a must-read. He was right. Dan Walters has seen a lot covering state politics, from having the front row seat to when Jerry Brown was first elected governor in 1975 up to today. A frequent guest on the Maddie Report, we're delighted to have him back to look back at California politics over the last four decades. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to begin with a brief discussion of Governor Pat Brown, Jerry Brown's father, who was governor from 1959 to 1967. People look back at his tenure and they think of, you know, the big projects that were completed, like the State Water Project, transportation improvements and the like, and wonder if that can ever happen again. Why was he able to get so much done, and will that ever happen again?
Well, you know, I suppose Pat Brown deserves credit, but you also have to understand it was a particular era in California history. The state was a much simpler place economically and culturally and demographically than it is now. It was an easier place to govern, in short. And it was an era during the Kennedy administration, one thing, but that people had not yet lost their faith in government that came along later with Vietnam and Watergate. So it was a moment in time. And he took advantage of that moment in time and did some things that we still cherish, certainly. But you can't, you know, you have to temper all the credit you give to Pat Brown, again, to the times that he lived in. And the times that it was just kind of the idea that government could do things, people trusted it, they had things that they wanted to be done, and the politicians responded to that. There was a kind of a synchronization, if you will, of society and government at that time that's since been lacking.
So an opportunity that he seized.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Ronald Reagan. They're talking about electing a statue to Ronald Reagan at the state capitol. What kind of governor was Ronald Reagan?
Well, he was a lot less conservative than most people remember him by, particularly the Republicans remember him being. After all, he signed the Therapeutic Abortion Act. He signed the California Environmental Quality Act, the act that Republicans hate
CEQA.
Now. CEQA. Signed welfare reform that put in automatic cost of living increases for welfare recipients. Signed an historic deal that basically started emptying the state mental hospitals. He made a lot of deals with a Democratic legislator and Democratic legislative leaders at the time, particularly Bob Moretti, the Speaker of the Assembly, that seems almost quaint today. You couldn't even envision those sorts of grand bargains. Arnold Schwarzenegger tried to kind of resurrect that notion, but it didn't resonate the same kind of way because he didn't have the same Republican backing that Ronald Reagan had at the time, because the Republican contingent in the legislature during the 60s and early 70s was also a more moderate, less conservative group.
How would you compare Jerry Brown of today with the Jerry Brown the first time he was in office?
Well, kind of night and day. The first Jerry Brown governorship was a perpetual campaign. He ran for governor in 74, president in 76, governor again in 78, president again in 1980, and U.S. Senate in 1982. So his whole governorship was one perpetual campaign. Everything was geared to the next campaign, whatever it might be. this time, and he didn't govern very much. You know, he would kind of land in Sacramento occasionally, make some pronouncements and zip off, and he had a terrible relationship with the legislature. I think maybe he sees this second governorship, whether he's ever actually framed it that way, as a kind of a mulligan, as they say in golf, a do-over. And he left a lot of stuff on the plate when he left in 1983, and a lot of it was still there when he got back in 2011. And he wants to do over. He wants to do some stuff that will put him in a better light, I think, in the history books. And he has nothing else better to do. As he says, he's at my age. I got nothing else to do, so I might as well do this. So I think he sees it as an opportunity to kind of polish up his otherwise kind of dismal record as governor.
I want to get one last question in this segment, and that is, it's been said that California has a plural executive branch where there is a dispersion of power among several offices, and education is a good example. You've got the governor who guides ed policy. There's the elected superintendent of public instruction that oversees the Department of Education, but the Department of Education takes its cues from the State Board of Education, whose members are appointed by the governor, and then there's the Assembly and Senate education committees. It's all pretty
local
confusing.
Local school boards and local superintendents and everything else.
Very confusing. Does that obscure accountability and undermine the ability to develop coherent policies?
It absolutely undermines accountability. I mean, we took the idea of separation of powers, the idea of this competing sort of interests and competing kind of governance to an extreme level in California. We put it on steroids. And as a result, we have many cooks stirring the soup, and no one's responsible for what it really tastes like. And so it does damage accountability a lot. And we should simplify that structure so that the voters know who to hold accountable for outcomes.
We're talking with Dan Walters, political columnist with the Sacramento Bee. In the 1970s, the California legislature was described as, quote, the finest in the world, unquote, because of its expertise, diligence, and collegiality. The opinion of the California legislature, however, has undergone a stunning decline in the last 40 years. So what happened? Jesse Unruh, who was the Speaker of the Assembly from 1961 to 69, helped pass Prop 1A in 1966 that created a full-time legislature. So the question is the full-time legislature doing a better job than the part-time legislature it replaced?
No, it's not. But it may not be just because it's a full-time legislature. There's so many other factors that play into it. California has undergone an enormous change in that period of economic change, cultural change. We just discovered, for example, that Latinos will be the largest single ethnic group in California sometime this year. So it's a huge, hugely different place. And the legislature is a hugely different place, not only because it became a full-time body, but the later imposition of term limits changed the place. And then just simply the cultural polarization of the state. Both parties have shrunken, Republicans and Democrats. In fact, in some ways, the shrinkage in the Democratic Party is more stark than that in the Republican
Party.
They're
not going to another party. They're going to decline the state.
And becoming decline the state. So the parties have now distilled themselves into their more ideologically rigid subcultures. And the people who used to be either kind of moderate Democrats or moderate Republicans are now out there has declined the state. And that's being reflected in the legislature. Your namesake, Ken Matty, was kind of personified the earlier era of collegiality and compromise and moderation. And that's gone by the boards in both parties. Republicans have become much more conservative. Democrats have become much more liberal. The public employee unions now are a big issue that didn't exist then. So everything has changed, and mostly California has changed, and governing a state with such complexity becomes more difficult. And so the legislature has, in some ways, mirrored what's gone on in California, and in some ways just become an impediment to adjusting to that change that's gone on in California. And as a result, the legislature is not as effective a body as it once was during a so-called golden age. And by the way, the people who uttered those paeans to the legislature, I've actually contacted both of those for a book chapter I wrote a few years ago, and they all now have reneged on all that, and they say they were wrong, that the full-time professional legislature was not really the way to go in California.
Well, let's talk about one of the more powerful speakers of the Assembly, Willie Brown. He was speaker from 1980 to 1995, and he became one of the targets for the term limit supporters. How would you evaluate his performance as speaker?
Willie was entertaining, highly intelligent, a master of the legislative process and the political process, without a doubt. He described himself once as the Ayatollah of the legislature, and that was absolutely true. However, he used very little of that ability and that power to basically further the public agenda. It was mostly in the service of Willie Brown and maintaining his speakership. And he didn't really do a very good job of shepherding the... He wasn't the only one who didn't do a good job, but he didn't use that. And it was. And he also fostered a certain level of kind of institutional corruption that manifested itself in term limits back in 1990. So he was brilliant, but he limited his brilliance to very mundane things and not to the larger purposes of government.
Well, let me ask you about term limits. Has that been good or bad for California?
I could argue at 51-49 either way. Term limits did do certain things. They broke up the old boys network. They actually allowed a lot of ethnic minorities, what used to be called minorities, at least Latinos particularly, more women into the legislature. It was an old boys club. It was a middle-aged white men's club before. Opened it up. I told Cruz Bustamante from Fresno one time, Cruz, you wouldn't have been Speaker of the Assembly, you wouldn't have been Lieutenant Governor, and you wouldn't even been in the legislature had it not been for two things that your party opposed, term limits and court-ordered redistricting. And he had to admit that that was true. So it had that effect, but it also had the effect of shortening the attention span of the legislature and making it, in some respects, less capable of dealing with the issues that face such a complex and changing state.
Well, one of the issues is oversight. How do you think the legislature has done in terms of oversight?
Poorly. It always talks about it and doesn't do it. The only time it seems to do oversight is when there's some sensational thing that they cannot ignore, particularly if it involves the governor of the opposite party. And other than that time, they just don't do a very good job at all. The oversight basically falls to either dedicated oversight agencies like the auditor's office or the legislative analyst's office or to the media. We're the ones that do the oversight, basically, rather than the legislature, and that's one of its failings.
Well, let me ask you one last question. That is the importance of relationships in the legislative process. How important is that?
Well, as again, using Maddie as an example, they're very important if the legislators are around long enough to take advantage of. One of the problems with term limits is nobody was around long enough to actually develop relationships. Now, with a lengthening or a modification of term limits, that may come back into play. But it still have the situation where you have Democrats are very, very liberal, Republicans are very, very conservative. So collegiality cannot unto itself bridge that ideological gap. And so it helps, but it only takes you so far.
We're talking with Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. In 1911, California voters decided to establish the initiative process, which created a hybrid government, one part representative democracy and one part direct democracy. Today, Californians use direct democracy through the initiative process more than any other state. So there seems to be an extraordinary use of propositions in California. What impact does that have on the legislative process?
Well, it has a lot of impact. It's kind of hard to argue which came first, the chicken or the egg. Did the legislature become dysfunctional because of the initiatives, or do the initiatives reflect the dysfunctionality of the legislature? And I don't know the answer to that question. It's a little bit of both, probably. But clearly, over the last 35 years, ever since the passage of Proposition 13 in 1978, 35 years, the initiative has evolved into the major vehicle for making public policy in California. What happens in the legislature is either aimed at responding to an initiative that's already passed, trying to thwart an initiative that's been proposed, or trying to change the rules of initiatives so that they can't happen again. The initiative now is king. The people who finance initiatives make public policy in California, the big stuff. The legislature, at best, deals with the little stuff.
You know, polls show that citizens believe that they make better public policy decisions than the legislators they elect. Yet those same polls show that California voters are generally ignorant about the most important facts of state government, like what's the chief source of revenue or what's the chief expenditure. So are we just getting the government we deserve?
Well, maybe we are. Maybe we, like so many other things in California, something that's good is taken to wretched excess. And we're the masters of wretched excess in California, and the initiative process is an example of that. It seemed to be working well as a safety valve at one point, and somebody said, oh, well, if you can do this, we can do that, we can do this, we can do that. And suddenly the initiative process, with nobody ever giving it much thought, became this vehicle for making public policy in California. Do the voters make better decisions? I think not, because they make very contradictory decisions. They do one thing one time, another thing another time. They sometimes do the same things in the same election. They contradict one another. So I don't think voters are equipped to make those kinds of decisions, the very complex issues on taxation and other things. It should still be a safety valve but it should not be a primary policy vehicle, and that's what it's become. Now, how do you do get away from that? Well, for one thing, the legislature could do a better job, and maybe people wouldn't feel as frustrated, and we go out and do it. Maybe they need to have some more curbs. I'm thinking maybe we need to have a higher signature threshold for initiatives or something like that. It's gotten out of hand.
Well, let's talk about some of the propositions. Obviously, one of the most famous is Proposition 13 in 1978, where it created a property tax limit of 1% of the assessed value on property, and it had this two-thirds requirement for passing most taxes. Some say it effectively altered the balance of power between the state and local governments. What do you say?
Oh, it's true. If I ever write another book about California politics, it's going to be called Unintended Consequences. And it had the unintended consequence of shifting authority for financing schools and much of what had been locally financed in county governments to the state. And, of course, the state starts providing the money. They start dictating how the money is going to be spent. And it created a whole different dynamic of fiscal politics in California. Basically said that everything is one big budget. School budgets, county budgets, city budgets, the state budget are basically one budget because it intermingled all of this to a degree. Nobody intended that to happen necessarily. It was the unintended consequence of making a single purpose decision to do something about runaway property taxes, and they were running away at the time, and something needed to be done about them, has all sorts of ancillary impacts, and that's true of so many of the initiatives. They don't always have the impacts that people advertise, and they many have impacts that people don't understand.
Well, let's talk about kind of the other end of the continuum, Prop 98, which says that the legislature has to basically allocate about 40% of the state budget to education every year. What are the consequences for ballot box budgeting measures like Prop 98?
Well, they tie the hands of the legislature. They make it more difficult for the legislature to be effective, and thereby creating more frustration, which then breeds more initiatives. It's a self-perpetuating process. Proposition 98, I've written a couple of times, only three people in the whole state profess to understand it, and then they don't agree on what it means. The guy who wrote it has joked that he wrote it so complicated so that people would have to hire him to explain it, and he could send his children through Stanford University. I mean, it's a mess. It's an absolute disaster. Nobody really can fact. So every year they pick a number. Although nobody knows it's the right number, and then they fight over that number, and then they can't afford to do that number, so they do the number on paper, and then they delay the payment of the rest of the number, and the schools then sue, and it's a mess.
There's so many propositions to talk about. Proposition 187, the propositions dealing with election reforms, open primaries and stuff like that. You got Prop 8. What is the impact of all these propositions on public policy?
Is to the cumulative impact is to render California ungovernable or close to ungovernable by any rational standard. It's not the only factor that causes ungovernability, but it is a major factor in what I've called the crisis of governance in California, our chronic inability to come to grips with the issues that face a mobile and growing society and deal with those issues, whether it's transportation or education or water or a myriad other issues. We don't do a very good job of that. And we need to have an effective governmental apparatus, and the initiative process is one of the factors that make that dysfunction.
We're talking with Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. You know, some think that the political process is out of sync and unresponsive to the needs of most Californians. Do you agree? And if so, what legislative reforms should be considered?
Well, I do agree. I think we do have this crisis of governance, our kind of chronic inability to come to grips with our pressing issues. What we have is this kind of separation of powers put on steroids, in which nobody is truly accountable for outcomes. And without that accountability, then there's no real impetus to act. And we talked earlier about education being one of those examples, but it's certainly not the only example. Water, transportation, there are other examples. What we need to do is to simplify the lines of accountability and responsibility. We use a structure of government that we adopted in the 19th century from something created in the 18th century, and we've patched it, I don't know how many, 500 amendments to the state constitution. It's the second longest state constitution of any state.
And
we need
like to, a tax code.
We need to start out with a clean sheet of paper and say, what makes sense for California in the 21st century?
Are you advocating for a constitutional convention?
I think it's the only way it could probably be done. I don't think it would be ever done through the legislative process. constitutional conventions, clean sheet of paper. What makes sense for California? Should we talk about enlarging the legislature, which hasn't been changed for 150 years? I mean, if it made sense in 1865, why can't it make any sense now? Maybe a unicameral legislature, maybe even a parliamentary system, proportionate representation, things that would simplify the lines of accountability, separating out more what is local responsibility from what state responsibility, so that you know who's responsible for the outcome. If your kids aren't doing well in school, if the school is failing, you know who to hold accountable. If the streets aren't fixed, the highways are crowded, who do you hold accountable? We can't, we pass the buck. We have a wonderful system for passing the buck, a terrible system for accountability, and therefore it breeds cynicism in the public. The elections become exercises in hit pieces, and we don't govern ourselves very well. We don't. What is government? It's supposed to be the way we deal with our common problems, and we don't do it.
Well, let's talk about Exhibit A, about the dysfunctional nature of state politics, and that is the state budget. That's what everybody always points to. How can the state budget be improved? State budget process.
Well, you could eliminate a lot of the so-called ballot box budgeting stuff that's been put in the state constitution, saying you have to spend this here, you have to spend that here, you have to spend that here. Put it out on the table. Let people take responsibility for making the decision to spend that money and raise that money, for that matter. Why do we have to do everything through the ballot box? Why can't we do stuff through the process, the representative process? Because people don't trust the representative process because it's been a failure. I don't know where you break into that circle, but you have to break into that circle some way and say, you are accountable for this. You get elected to this office. You are accountable for what happens under your purview, and we haven't done that.
Well, maybe some of this distrust has turned into these supermajority rules. Some argue that supermajority rules grant tremendous power to a few at the expense of the majority. Others say it's a necessary check on overreach by the majority. What do you say?
I think that there are some things that are legitimately should be subjected to the supermajority rules. I don't think the legislature ought to put a measure on the ballot to change the state constitution, for example, without a supermajority vote. And there are certain things that just should require that because they are bedrock sorts of things. Just as we don't amend the U.S. Constitution without a ratification by the states, we don't let the Congress do that. There are certain things, but maybe there are too many of them. Basically, supermajority sometimes becomes a dodge. It becomes a way for politicians to hide from responsibility. We need to have people take responsibility for their decisions, but they also need to be accountable for them. You can't have gerrymandered legislative districts and unfettered power at the same time, because that doesn't solve your problem. You need to look at a system that is open, that is transparent, that is fair, and that has accountability, and that would take a constitutional convention.
Well, what about the emerging trends, like increased ethnic diversity in California? What impact is that going to have on politics in the state?
It's already having that impact. We saw that in the 2012 election, certainly, a big impact of a surge of voting by not only the young, but particularly the non-white voters. Still, I mean, whites are only less than 40% of the population of California now, but they're still 60, 65% of the voters. So that's, over time, that will erode because, frankly, the old people like me are getting old and we're going to die off. And so the new majorities in California of Latinos and Asians are going to be responsible for government in the future, and that's what we need to understand, that it's going to be a different kind of society.
Well, I want to thank Dan Walters for joining us and giving his retrospective on California politics.
Up next, what impact has state government had on the San Joaquin Valley? We'll talk to California State University Fresno professor Tom Holyoke, John Ellis, a political reporter with the Fresno Bee, and UC Merced professor Nate Monroe.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. What governors and legislators have left their mark and improved the lives of those in the San Joaquin Valley? And who have been among our best representatives in Sacramento? What made them so effective? We have three points of view on those questions. John Ellis, political reporter for the Fresno Bee, UC Merced political scientist Professor Nate Monroe, and Fresno State political science professor Tom Holyoke. Welcome all of you to the Matty Report.
Hello.
John, let's start with you. There seems to be a general feeling in the Valley, fair or not, that we're often overlooked by state leaders that are more focused on the Bay Area and L.A. Which governor over the past 30 or 40 years has been the most receptive, do you think, the Valley needs?
I don't know that any have. I mean, I think plenty have paid lip service. I mean, I think we counted the times that Arnold Schwarzenegger came to the Valley, and it was in the 70s, I believe, or the 80s in his time in office. But I didn't see any difference in pretty much anything. I mean, you know, the bills that are getting passed, the proposals that are made, highway, you know, I guess Highway 99 is finally starting to get improved little by little. But for the most part, the people are in the Bay Area. They're in L.A. That's where the money goes because that's where the people are. So we, although we are growing, we are still in a minority when it comes to being able to use our clout to be able to push our legislation.
So, Nate, the governor is just following where the votes are? What do you think?
I think that's partially true. I mean, you know, the way you asked the question originally, right, is which one's the most receptive to Valley needs? And I guess I think, you know, there's an important difference between, you know, whether the governor is receptive and how much he's really going to go to bat. So, you know, if I had to sort of identify one that might have been the most, you know, willing to listen to and maybe commiserate with the needs of Valley, maybe Gray Davis, right? An unlikely candidate who, you know, for any sort of lauding, but one that I think had relationships with a lot of Valley legislators from his time in the Assembly in the 80s, and really, you know, I think did as much as any governor we've had to try to, you know, understand and facilitate things for the Valley. That said, I agree that, you know, governors are in a lot of ways slaves to the votes, and the votes are not in the Valley.
Well, Tom, what do you think?
Well, sort of picking up on Nate's distinction between, you know, actually visiting the Valley and, you know, responding to Valley concerns, I'd actually give a little credit to the once and future governor, Jerry Brown, the younger Jerry Brown, the one we have now, in the sense that we don't think we see him here that often. I think he is trying to make a genuine effort to solve one of our most difficult problems around here, and that's the availability of water. He tried to do that back when he was governor, back in the early 80s with the peripheral canal. Now he's coming back to try it again with the twin tunnels. And while a lot of people here may not necessarily approve of what he's doing, I think he is making a major effort to solve one of our most intractable problems.
Professor Monroe, let's follow up on that. How would you compare Jerry Brown, the first time around, with the Jerry Brown of today when it comes to understanding and addressing Valley issues?
Well, you know, I guess I think one of the remarkable things is that I think in a lot of ways, the Jerry Brown then and the Jerry Brown now are the same, and everybody else has changed. You know, in the sense that, you know, at the time in the state, Jerry Brown was sort of perceived as someone who was a fairly progressive liberal, you know, in a lot of positions, and now all of a sudden, it's, I think, you know, shows up as somebody who looks a lot more like a conservative Democrat on a lot of fronts. And so, in that sense, I think, you know, he's aligned more closely with the Valley, with sort of Valley politics that are often moderate and unconventional in cross party lines on certain issues. And I think a lot of that is consistent with, you know, with Brown's politics. I mean, it's that showed up some in some of his redistribution of funds, you know, sending, you know, plans to send more, you know, education dollars to the Valley. You know, he sort of looks like he's lining up the Valley more now than he did the first time around.
John, what do you think? Is the Jerry Brown of today different than the Jerry Brown of yesterday when it comes to the Valley?
Well, I will say that I was in high school the first time around for Jerry Brown one, but I think what has changed, in my opinion, is I think that the people here have somewhat changed in their receptiveness towards him, or their realization that if they want to get anything at all, that they are going to have to play ball with him. And I think you've seen that in some of the West Side ag money that has been going to him and that went to Prop 30. You actually had some of these Westlands farmers that have that got on board donating money both to the pro Prop 30 effort and to Brown's 2014 reelection campaign. So if you're asking me, I think that although I was not around for Brown 1, I just know a lot of the perception is, and it makes a lot of these hardcore Republicans very angry, but I think that the mainstream business and ag community realizes that the Democrats are calling the shots in Sacramento. Brown is the governor. He almost sounds more the most moderate of all the Democrats up there, the most reasonable. So they are realizing this, and so they are going out there, and they are trying to actually court him, and I think it's somewhat paying off.
Tom, I want to ask you about Valley legislators. Who do you think has distinguished him or herself over the last 30 or 40 years?
You know, The Valley legislators that I have met, one person who actually impressed me in terms of integrity was Juan Arámbula. And that was, you know, his willingness to sort of defy, you know, the powers that be up in the Assembly. And of course, he suffered for it. He was, you know, kicked into the little office, the doghouse, and then, you know, he felt so strongly about it that he left the party. Now, did that make him effective? I actually have some doubts that that probably did, because, you know, once you no longer are on the majority party team, then you're not going to be able to do as much as you would otherwise. But it was certainly a good move in terms of integrity.
Well, John, who do you think? Which Valley legislators do you think have really distinguished themselves over the last 30 or 40 years?
Well, the ones that always stick out to me are always the Titans, because they seem that was in the pre-term limit era. And I think that term limits have really neutered what a lot of legislators can do up there. But I always think back, although, you know, I didn't share a ton of time with some of these people. But, you know, well, Ken Mattey, certainly, obviously the Mattey Institute, he predated me. I was not even here when he'd already passed away by the time I came to the B. But, you know, when people talk about him, Bill Jones, Chuck Puchigian, Jim Costa, some of their time in the state legislature. And I think that back then, you know, even when Willie Brown ran things, I do think that those guys were able to get more, you know, there's more collegiality, and I think there's more working between the parties. Even though when Willie had control, I think he was very cognizant of the opposing party and getting everybody to have a little something to take home to their districts. And so I think you think about the newer guys, and they're not really memorable because they're in there and they're out of there before you even know it. The old timers, I guess, you can call them now. Those guys seem to really be able to make a difference back in the day.
You know, Nate, kind of talking to really term limits here, right? I mean, what do you think? Do you think term limits has impacted the Valley's ability to have these distinguished leaders that they've had in the past? What impact has term limits had on Valley representation?
Well, I mean, I guess I'm not sure that, you know, it's a relative point, right? Because I don't know that term limits impacts the Valley's ability to do things any more or less than legislators from other parts of the state. I'm not sure term limits has done a real disservice, you know, to the Valley disproportionately. Although, and I maybe point out that some of the most distinguished leaders, at least up in the, you know, in the Central Valley, some of the most distinguished leaders have gone on to run for higher office and have moved out before, you know, term limits kicked them out anyway, you know, Dennis Cardoza and Gary Condit. And so some of those, you know, I'm not sure and Jim Costa. And so I'm not sure that term limits have been the thing that have taken away our state legislators, and certainly not any more so than other parts of the state.
Professor Holyoke, what do you think about term limits? Have they helped to hurt the Valley? Has it made our delegation more responsive, more representative? What are the good and bad points of term limits for the Valley?
I've never thought very highly of term limits at all, and I think it diminishes the effectiveness of legislators regardless of where they come from. Because essentially what happens is, you know, it takes years to understand how a legislature works. It takes years to build the kinds of networks and the kinds of partnerships that you need to get anything done in a majority rule institution. And while term limits are supposed to make legislators more accountable because they're not constantly running for re-election, what you end up with is members of the Assembly and State Senate who actually spend their time running for Congress.
Right.
So I'm not a big fan of this.
Yeah, and Professor Monroe, I want to ask you about some of these new reforms that have gone on in the last few years, like redistricting, open primaries, 12 years in one house. Do you think they're going to have a positive or negative, make a positive or negative difference in Valley representation in Sacramento?
Well, I think redistricting and open primaries certainly will have a positive impact from the perspective of the Valley, because the Valley is a place where Republicans and Democrats look a lot more like one another, those that we elect to send to Sacramento, than in other parts of the state. And I think what these things are doing is they're creating more competitive districts and more moderate districts in other parts of the state that will create more natural partnerships for Valley legislators to advocate their sort of general positions on things. I also think, just as a sort of offhand, I think, you know, 12 years in one house goes a little ways in, you know, trying to mitigate some of the negative effect of term limits, which I agree with the previous comment entirely. You know, they're very negative from a sort of general legislative effectiveness standpoint.
Okay, Tom, what do you think? What do you think about these changes in these new reforms?
Actually, actually, I do kind of like the redistricting and the open primaries. I don't think they're going to have all that big of an effect here. What I actually am kind of a little happier with was extending the time that a legislator could stay in their own chamber up to 12 years now, simply because it gives them more time to learn the system, understand the system, and make a difference before they're finally term limited out.
You know, John, I want to ask you, you know, talking about, you know, with redistricting and open primaries and the rest, they're more competitive, these districts. Does that mean more money has to be raised by politicians? Are we seeing then more money in politics?
Well, there's only so much money to go around, so they're gonna target races. And I think it, you know, obviously, it's, you know, let's take for instance the 21st congressional where David Valadao won. You know, I think the party looked at John Hernandez, and although
the party being the Democratic Party
looked at John Hernandez, and they saw, even though they had a huge voter registration advantage. He was not the, you know, they didn't, in the end of the day, with the pot of money they had, you know, I think that they made a decision that he was not a viable candidate. So I think, there, you know, there may be more money, but I think, and it may be more competitive races, but there's still only going to be so much to go around. So I think in the long run, it's going to lead to more picking and choosing. I think, and then the interesting thing is, you know, what happens when you have two Republicans go at each other? You know, are we going to see, you know, the various parties picking and choosing, I guess, between one of the two candidates from the
Well, it's very interesting, and the chamber has been very good at this in terms of if it's a Democratic district, they'll support the moderate Democrat. Unions are now saying they're going to do the exact same thing with Republicans. When there are two Republicans up, they're going to support the moderate Republican. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Tom, I want to ask you about the part-time legislature. There have been some folks calling for that, most notably Jim Bourne of the Fresno Bee. Republican Assembly member Shannon Grove made a proposal last year about a part-time legislature. What do you think about a part-time legislature?
I'm not in favor of a part-time legislature for essentially the same reason that I'm not a big fan of term limits. You know, California is a complicated state, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort to learn how it all works. And so if you make legislators part-time, so they're spending only a small amount of time up in Sacramento, they simply are not going to have the tools they need to, you know, manage and govern the state. So who is going to end up governing the state? It's going to fall to the unelected. It's going to fall to legislative staff at best, and at worst, probably to interest group lobbyists, because they do know how things work, and they're going to be there all the time.
Nate, what do you think about a part-time legislature?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a terrible idea. And when you think about, you know, maybe there's a point in time when you really feel like the problems in the state are a result of legislators being disconnected from their district. That's just not where we're at. You know, if anything, right, the problem is exactly the opposite. It's that we don't have a legislative environment that has enough expertise and enough sort of longevity of careers to make it so that, you know, members are interested in investing in longer-term solutions to problems. And so I think a part-time legislature just goes to exacerbate the problems that already exist.
Well, let me ask John a question here about the importance of relationships in making the legislative process more effective. Is it essential or overblown, the importance of relationships?
Oh, I would say it's everything, especially for somebody, let's say you're in right now the minority party, you're a Republican up there, and you're not even— You know, they can essentially ignore you. They don't even have to do anything. They can push through everything. I think your relationship that you may establish with the speaker or with some of the leadership of the opposing party could be vital in just getting some legislation passed that may be specific to your particular district. You know, obviously, you're not going to carry any big legislation. They're not going to let anything through. But I do believe that even in this atmosphere, that there is probably some willingness for some specific legislation that may help an individual district. But I think, and that to me is everything about that's relationships and what kind of relationships you build up there in Sacramento.
Nate, what do you think? Relationships important or not important?
I think they're essential and they're overblown. I mean, I guess
gotta pick
relationships
one.
Matter, you know, and they do now, they always will. But I also think that there's some inevitability to the politics of certain situations, right? No matter how good the relationship is, there are just certain deals that can't get done. They're just not politically viable. And so I think, you know, I think we should, you know, we need to, you know, appreciate sometimes that the politics of a certain circumstance aren't amenable to a good relationship, a heavy influence by a lobbyist, or any other thing. You know, there's just political realities sometimes that are what they are.
Okay, I'm going to give Tom a chance to kind of weigh in here in about 10 seconds. Are relationships important?
Very important. How can you build a majority without one?
Okay, great. Well, that was short. Up next, what about direct democracy and all those propositions? Are they making California government better or making California ungovernable? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. We're taking a look back at state government over the last 30 or 40 years and discussing how decisions in the state capital have impacted the San Joaquin Valley. With UC Merced political science professor Nate Monroe, Fresno State political science professor Tom Holyoke, and John Ellis, political reporter for the Fresno Bee. So, Nate, let me start with you. There seems to be an extraordinary use of propositions in California. What impact have they had on the Valley? And on balance, have propositions been good or bad for the Valley? And there's been a lot of them, so pick and choose whichever one you want to talk about.
Well, let me make a little bit of a more general statement, and that is, we referenced sort of governors following the votes. There's a similar dynamic at play when we talk about propositions, right? I mean, it creates the opportunity for voters in the Bay Area and in Southern California to sort of team up in as much as they have common interests to move funds or restrict spending in a way that disproportionately advantages those areas to the disadvantage of the Valley. And I think, you know, across these propositions, there have been a number of instances where the basic economic interests of the Valley, agricultural needs, there are other kinds of labor needs, educational needs, have been sort of hijacked a bit by the direct democracy process because of the sort of disproportionate share of votes that are outside of the Valley.
Tom, what do you think?
Well, rather than choosing a particular one to like or not like, I would like to say that I really don't like the whole process of these at all. That this essentially, this business about going around the state legislature essentially lets the state legislature off the hook. I mean, we're a representative democracy, and they are supposed to be doing the people's business and not kicking the can over like this. When you get these propositions, they're usually pretty ham-handed. A lot of people do not understand them, and yet the effects they can have are extremely profound. In fact, California, as far as I can tell, has been suffering between the rock and a hard place of Prop 13 and Prop 98 for decades now.
Can you explain? Everybody, I think, knows what Prop 13 is, the property tax, but what is Prop 98 for folks who might not know?
Prop 98 is the one that directs a significant portion of state revenue towards K-12 and community college education, which means that's a lot of money that is immediately dedicated to education, which is great, but that means we have almost no flexibility then to use money for other purposes.
Right. It's called ballot box budgeting.
Exactly. And Prop 13 is drastically limited the amount of revenue going for to local government, so that local government essentially is getting pushed aside by state government.
John, what do you think? What about these propositions, and what impact have they had on the Valley?
Well, I don't know how much I can add, because I think the professors have done a very good job of addressing this. I always thought that they're such a distraction. You have these hot-button ones like, say, Prop 8, the gay marriage one, and it just takes away from the real business of governing in California, and so all this money goes in, you're inundated by commercials, your attention is off, your eye's not on the ball. And I think that, in a way, it's bad for California because, it's like a sideshow when we should be doing some real governing. And so in the long run, I think that doesn't benefit the Valley at all, and because— once again, when you're distracted, then things are just business as usual, which means L.A. and San Francisco benefit and we don't.
Yeah, and a lot of the propositions are being backed by single persons or interest groups and a lot of wealthy individuals. In fact, last time around, last November, most of the propositions were being put forward by a single individual. So, there's a question of whether or not that's democratic. But let's go into another question about polls. I want to ask Tom about this one. He'll start off this one. Polls show that citizens believe that they make better public policy decisions than their elected officials. Yet those same polls show that voters really don't know some basic facts about state government. Are we just getting the government we deserve?
Actually, yes, I think that's true. And I think, if anything, we need a proposition that will direct a great deal more money down to the universities for funding basic American government and California government courses.
That sounds a little self-serving there, Tom.
It's just a little self-serving. No, but the point of the matter is that, yeah, a lot of people do not know even the basics of how their national government or how their state government works. So I would not be convinced that the voters are also making good public policy decisions, too, at the ballot. ballot box.
John, as a reporter, you're trying to explain this stuff to the voters. What are you finding? Do you think the public is generally informed or uninformed?
Well, uninformed. I mean, everybody wants to spend, but nobody wants to pay the taxes that's required to cover the spending that they want to always do. And I think, you know, if we want to look at this, let's look at the turnout in the coming two special elections for the 16th Senate District and for Measure G, the trash question here in Fresno about privatizing the residential trash hauling. I think that is going to tell you all you need to know about the level of participation in this in the area. Yet people always have an opinion, and usually that opinion is, yes, I like that. Yes, I like that. I want that. I want this. But they're not informed enough to know that all these things cost money.
Nate, what do you think? Are we getting just the government we deserve?
Well, I think that I don't think we're getting the government we deserve. I think we're getting the government that we've created for ourselves by creating faulty institutions. I mean, the reality is that most voters, let alone most citizens, are not particularly well informed by almost anyone's standard. But certainly, voters aren't anything like the experts that legislators and staff members and lobbyists are in Sacramento. Now, you can have all kinds of arguments about whether or not those individuals have the right motives. But the idea that citizens should be making policy decisions and are in some ways better at governing than those who spend their entire professions doing that is just silly.
Okay, well, I think some individual voters may disagree with you on that, but let me switch gears a little bit and talk about a more philosophical question. We'll go back to you, Nate, on this one. And that is this whole issue of local control and flexibility versus setting state minimum standards. You know, is local control a good thing for the Valley because it'll foster innovation and be more tailored to our local needs? Or would it result in kind of a second-class environment, environmental labor standards for the Valley, as we try to lower the bar to attract businesses in our region? What do you think about that issue?
Well, probably both. I mean, I think the reality is that a lot of times the way that standards are set outside of the Valley are done, you know, with the interests of entirely, you know, different regions in mind, and without even considering the economic trade-offs within the Valley. On the other hand, in the short, in the near term, I think you run the risk of exactly what you suggest, which is, you know, we have every incentive in the Valley from an economic interest to try to make it an appealing environment, which might mean, you know, labor standards that are not good for the basic working class individuals in the Valley. So I think it's sort of, you know, it's a double-edged sword.
You want to jump in on that, Tom?
But just in the sense that local control works when you truly have purely local issues, but how many issues are truly local? You know, a lot of the problems that come up and that government has to deal with are, you know, statewide issues in the sense that a problem may begin in one part of the state and affect another part of the state. Like a lot of the environmental concerns on water that we have. I mean, water is often portrayed here as a local issue, but most of the water we use here comes down out of Northern California. And a lot of the environmental concerns that have caused restrictions in the amount of water have happened in other parts of the state. So an issue like that is really a statewide issue because all the problems leading into it are occurring in different parts of the state. So let local control be for purely local issues.
You know, I want to end with this, and I want to see what each of you think about the San Joaquin Valley going forward in terms of state politics. What role do you think, John, we're going to play in state politics going forward?
Well, our population is increasing. I just don't know that we have a bench. I keep looking at the bench, the political bench of the major political parties, and I keep wondering if there's, you know, the kind of dynamic leader that can step up and take advantage of the new way we elect people, the way term limits have been altered, that you can serve your 12 years in one house or the other. And although I think that there's opportunity here, I don't know if we have the people that can rise to the occasion and take advantage of that.
Nate, what do you think? Going forward, where do you see the San Joaquin Valley? What role do you think they're going to play in state politics?
Well, let me answer John's question. I think the answer is yes. And I think that's precisely the reason why I think there is going to be an increasing influence in the San Joaquin Valley. And that is, let me just give you a couple of quick numbers. There's about 40 new, brand new freshman assemblymen right now, right? So about half the chamber. And that theoretically could now hang around for the next 12 years and will be the senior class for that entire time. Of the 80, there's also about 35 that are at least loosely affiliated with the moderate caucus in the assembly. Right. And I think some of the core moderate legislators are members that, you know, are some of these freshman members, some of these newer members like Henry Perea, Adam Gray in the assembly, Anthony Cannella on the Senate side, really sort of promising young legislators from the Valley who have the opportunity and I think the potential to step up and lead the statewide moderate movement more influence for the Palatine Valley.
Well, that'll be interesting to see going forward. I want to thank Fresno State political science professor Tom Holyoke, John Ellis, political reporter for the Fresno Bee, and UC Merced political science professor Nate Monroe for joining us. If you want to keep up to date with state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, by just logging on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for The Maddie Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.